Wow, this is bad.
I have no idea what Judaism is. Really, I don't. I never studied the Jewish religion. I don't know anything about it. I think that Zionism, I know something about because I wrote my doctoral dissertation on the topic.
Wow, this is really bad. You might know him, Norman Finkelstein. He's a independent academic today because back in 2007 he lost his tenure, or was denied his tenure at DePaul University in Chicago because, you know, yes, there was intense political pressure on him at the time, basically because he was daring to criticize Israel. And he wrote the, you know, the Holocaust industry. That didn't help, obviously. But despite meeting publishing standards, he had his vocal feud with Alan Dershowitz, apparently, at the time, and there was a failure by the school, they claimed, for him to meet the Vincentian values, which led to a 4-3 board vote against Finkelstein. So, you know, Finkelstein has become kind of like an orthodox dissident, if that's what you want to call it. He's kind of like an insider-outsider. He's become a to-go-to voice on the issue of Israel-Palestine, everything related to Zionism, obviously. He wrote, as I said, a dissertation on Zionism. So he's kind of like an expert on the topic. So I haven't listened that much to him, but I was kind of floored when I like heard this. Like, are you serious? You claim to be kind of an expert on Zionism and a voice for us to understand, allegedly, the Israeli-Palestine issue, but you've never studied the Jewish religion? That's kind of a big deal, you know? A critical failure in understanding Zionism. And it doesn't matter what Zionism, political Zionism, religious Zionism, labor Zionism, you have revisionist Zionism, you have cultural Zionism, you even have liberal Zionism. And they claim they are, you know, all kind of different versions or whatever. Yeah, they're different roads, but they're leading all to the same destination. So what is that destination? What do they have in common? Well, let's dive into this for a bit. First, I think it's important and vital to understand that Zionism is inseparable from Judaism. Judaism is Zionism, and Zionism is Judaism. Without Judaism, there wouldn't be Zionism. And without Zionism, there wouldn't be Judaism, at least in the version that we have it today. So the foundation is religious, right? To pretend otherwise is, I mean, it's damage control. And maybe that's what Norman Finkelstein is engaging in. Considering the fact that he's a leftist Jew, a so-called anti-Zionist Jew, that's highly likely. That's how they like to control the discourse. Go to the guy that will actually never tell you the truth about the matter. He's the voice to. He's the suppressed voice that you can go to if you want to get the real truth about the issue of Zionism, apparently. So the foundations are religious. It's important to understand. It's theology. So you can hardly talk about Zionism without going into Theodor Herzl, obviously, because that, you know, that's where people begin. Well, that's where the Zionist movement begins, which is bullshit because it's religious. So it goes way back, right? But let's start with Theodor Herzl, one of the founders of Zionism and the Zionist movement. And of course, he was influenced by the Tanakh, or the Hebrew Bible, in his thinking for what the borders of the Jewish state in Palestine should be. There's an initial settlement portion, which of course is Zion, Mount Moriah, the city of David, all these things, right, where the temple was. But then you have the expansive covenant map. It's in Genesis 15:18. You can read it in Exodus 23:31. From the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. The slogan that Herzl used was the Palestine of David and Solomon. And if you read the Wikipedia thread on this, they're actually kind of trying to almost blame this on an English, you know, Protestant Zionist Anglican, William Heckler. He was actually not English. He was born in Germany. He's German stock. So I guess an Anglo. They're doing like the eternal Anglo kind of thing to this. And we'll return to this because much of this is like, well, if these Jews are proponents of Zionism, live in England when they're doing it, then it's English people that did it. If they were in Poland, then it's Polish people that did it. This is kind of the leftist argument in order to blame whites and Europeans. But anyway, Why don't we check in with Lord Rothschild on this matter? He has something to say about it. Jacob Rothschild.
As we all in this audience know, it took more than 2,000 years for the Jews to recover their historic home.
In modern Jewish history, and it begins with three words. Dear Lord Rothschild.
Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet.
Why was it that this letter was sent by the Foreign Secretary to your great uncle Walter?
It's an interesting question because it was primarily a movement from Eastern Europe, but they didn't clarify who was in charge of that movement. And in addition, it was, after all, in Great Britain. So they felt that the Rothschild family should be the one to whom it was addressed. And Walter was Lord Rothschild, and he was a Zionist. And those really are the background reasons.
And here it is, the Balfour Declaration. What do you feel when you see it here?
I genuinely feel it's one of the most extraordinary moments in the history of the Jewish people. If you think it took 3,000 years to get to this. And then you say, how did this miracle happen? And it's the most incredible piece of opportunism. I mean, if you think you had an impoverished would-be scientist, Chaim Weizmann, who somehow gets to England, meets a few people, including members of my family, seduces them. He has such great charm and conviction. He gets to Balfour, and he unbelievably persuades Balfour and Lloyd George, the Prime Minister, and most of the ministers, that this idea of the national home for Jews should be allowed to take place. I mean, it's so, so unlikely. And then you have the bit that nothing that's to be done should in any way harm the Arab community. But you come back to the big point, which is that this is perhaps the greatest event in Jewish life for thousands of years.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. Now, the part there about the Arabs, though, of course, obviously, that not harming the Arabs, that definitely panned out here, as we know. They view them as Canaanites. And, of course, that's actually what they are genetically. We'll get to that later. But anyway, the part there about Chaim Weizmann is always interesting, right? Somehow he just miraculously managed to convince everyone around. There was nothing else going on at the time. He just managed to kind of get in with the Rothschilds and get in with Lord Balfour and get in with the... Anyway, it was an interesting piece. And this goes a little deeper in terms of the era around World War One, the strategic interest of the British at the time. And if it wasn't this, it would have been something else 10 years later or 10 years earlier or 20 years later or 50 years earlier. They kept pushing and pushing and pushing. And finally, the pieces were in place. And this is the thing that unlocked it. So it's not that it was like some, this was the only bet chance that they had to achieve this, you know, the creation of Israel in this kind of way. They would have done it in some kind of other way, probably. But they talk about the, actually what's happening, the piece from the foreword is called The Dark Force Behind the Balfour Declaration and Its Lasting Legacy. And of course, surprisingly, they basically blame whites. They blame conspiratorial white people in the piece. The genesis of the declaration had little to do with Zionism, oh, of course, and everything to do with World War One. British interests in the war, power politics, and anti-Semitism. Indeed, the declaration derived from classic European anti-Judaism and from the Gentile English version of anti-Semitism. This is just... Wow. The chutzpah, the gall. Anyway, the story begins not in Palestine, but in Ottoman Turkey, in 1908, so 9 years before the Balfour Declaration finally signed, right? With the beginning of the revolution of the Committee of Union and Progress, also known as the Young Turks, really, which ultimately established hegemony over the Ottoman Sultanate. The leaders of the Young Turks uprising were viewed with sympathy by British Foreign Office in London, but with disdain by the British Embassy in Constantinople, where it counted. As historian David Frumkin tells us, another Jew, the British ambassador, Sir Gerald Lowther, fell completely under the influence of his first dragoman, his advisor on Middle Eastern affairs, Gerald Fitzmaurice, who detested the Young Turks. Why? Well, they explain here for us. To Fitzmaurice, the fact that the Young Turk Revolution began in 1908 in Salonika, Greece, then under Ottoman rule, was significant. More than half of Salonika's inhabitants were Jews. This, plus the fact that Salonika had a Freemason lodge founded by a Jew, was enough for Fitzmaurice, who himself was entirely taken with the notion of a, quote, international Jewish conspiracy. There it is. Nothing to this, obviously, of course. Some of them managed to kind of push all the leaders around and kind of get their way as string pullers. But that's not what's going on here. This is just British interests, okay? The CUP, or this Committee of Union and Progress, a.k.a. the Young Turks, was part of an international Jewish Freemason conspiracy, the Jew Committee of Union and Progress. And Fitzmaurice convinced his boss, Lowther, who was a rather fool to begin with, of this canard. Okay, there you go. Okay, so look, I don't know much about these historical characters, but if the Ford writes about it in this way, obviously there's some truth. Them denying it is an admission that there's something to it. That's usually how these things read. The Fitzmaurice and Lowther report won wide acceptance among British officials in London and led to a profound misconception about Middle East power and politics that a group of Jews wielded political power in the Ottoman Empire. This was absolutely true, as far as I've read it. Indeed, everywhere in the world at the time, the misconception was common enough. It found particular sinister expression in the Tsarist forgery, the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. Here we go. But in this case, the obvious conclusion was drawn. The Great War, in which Britain was then heavily engaged, could be won by buying the support of this powerful group, but brought with which coin? Zionism, of course, they write. With British Zionists making the case for the notion of a British-allied post-war Jewish Palestine. To the British, this translated into Jewish support for their war effort, which could be bought by the promise of support of establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. So if the Jews didn't have any power, as they deny in the piece, why did Britain need Jewish support for their war effort? Anyway, this notion, a natural to Fitzmaurice and his obsession with Jewish power, persuaded the Foreign Office to pledge British support to the Zionist enterprise. And then they talk about Lloyd George and how his English Protestantism celebrated the Old Testament Hebrews. Now, that's true, of course, right? This is the critique we have. Without Protestantism, Catholicism, any denomination of Christianity, especially, of course, evangelical Christianity, but that was a little later, a little bit more of an American phenomenon. But still, if you didn't have that in the European people, there would be no hook that Jews could have in with the white race, with Europe, right? We wouldn't care about it. It had nothing to do with us. It didn't matter. So here they got him, right? But the fact that they're solely putting it on these people, it's kind of like it was an English Protestant phenomenon. That's what it was. It is true that Lloyd George, English Protestantism, celebrated the Old Testament Hebrews. Well, maybe he shouldn't have, right? It was not uncommon among English Protestants to have deep feelings about the Jewish connection to the Holy Land, but it's more to the point that Lloyd George and the people around him were taken with the notion of Jewish international networking. They were just taken with it. They were taken with the notion of Jewish international networking. Well, which one is it? Does it exist or does it not exist? And more so with international Jewish power, bringing Jewish power into the picture precisely when Britain needed help in the war effort. Again, if they have no power, why do they need to go to them? See how they contradict each other and make a point about, oh, it's that they believe, this anti-Semite believed it was an international Jewish conspiracy. And then, like, oh, the Jewish international networking. Oh, let's rephrase it a little bit. Bringing Jewish power into the picture precisely when Britain needed help in the war effort might ensure financial assistance to Allied cause, and he might even help to bring America into the war. And of course, the rest is history. But anyway, the British government never learned that Lowther and Fitzmaurice had supplied it with a warped view of Ottoman politics, one in which the Ottoman government was pictured as a tool of world Jewry. In fact, this backdrop served as a perfect setting for the Balfour Declaration. Now, of course, I don't think the Ottoman government in and of itself was a control, but there was the Young Turks aspect of it, right? When they gained more power, that was the thing that posed as Turks, and it turns out that they were Jews disproportionately. And of course, that's when you have the Armenian genocide by the Young Turks, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, so they blame it on white people. They blame it on the English. They blame it on Protestants. Not a big surprise. So what about the biblical reference to Amalek today, made by people like Netanyahu? Is that not biblical? Has that nothing to do with Judaism? Finkelstein, listen.
You must remember what Amalek has done to you, says our Holy Bible.
The extremism reflected in these activists, both online and in the mainstream media, is coming from the top, from the Prime Minister himself, calling up biblical references of brutal retaliation. To his defense minister. And his far-right coalition partner, Itamar Ben-Gvir, seen here at a rally in this clip shared online.
Let's listen to some more from Netanyahu. Norman Finkelstein, of course, is one of the main critics of Netanyahu, and he's kind of one of these guys who just thinks we'll get rid of him and everything else will be great. But here she is talking about Isaiah, these prophecies, the people of light versus dark. Listen.
Our war against Hamas is a test for all of humanity. It is a struggle between the axis of evil of Iran, Hezbollah, and Hamas, and the axis of freedom and progress. We are the people of the light. They are the people of darkness, and light shall triumph over darkness. It is now a time to come together for one purpose, to storm ahead to achieve victory, in joint with joint forces and a profound belief in our justness, a profound belief in the eternity of the Jewish people, we shall realize the prophecy of Isaiah. There will no longer be stealing at your borders, and your gates will be of glory. Together we will fight. Together we will win.
Yeah, it doesn't sound religious at all. I don't know what Zionism has anything to do with Judaism. I don't understand this at all. Of course, this reflects downstream as well. And this is some of the Israelis, how they view it.
It's a war. It doesn't matter who your enemy is. You need to destroy their offspring to prevent them from creating more offspring.
That's Old Testament Judaism right there. That's the Tanakh. That's what that is. And of course, on the flip side, you can look at the supposed opposition, right? Yair Lapid, Naftali Bennett. These guys, they have the exact same view. Even if Netanyahu himself was removed, it wouldn't be any difference. This is not a Netanyahu problem.
תראה, יש לי ויכוח ברמה התנכית, מה גבולות ארץ ישראל המקוריים. הפרט זה, אם פעם אחת בדקתי, זה היה בעיראק. לא נראה לי שכשאמריקאים נכנסו לעיראק הם חוו נחת גדולה. אני תומך בכל דבר שיאפשר ליהודים ארץ גדולה, רחבה, חזקה ומקלט בטוח לנו, לילדינו ולילדי ילדינו. בזה אני.
כמה רחבה?
כמה שאפשר.
עד
עיראק? לא, הדיון הוא דיון ביטחוני. זה שאנחנו בארץ אבותינו, והסיבה שאנחנו מדינת עמדת יש עתידי כדלקמן. הציונות מבוססת על התנ"ך, המנדט שלנו על ארץ ישראל הוא תנ"כי, גבולות ארץ ישראל התנ"כיים הם ברורים. יש גם שיקולים של ביטחון ושל מדיניות ושל זמן, 2,000 שנה היינו בגלות, אתה לא באמת רוצה את כל ההרצאה הזאת, נכון? לפחות לא הכי גדולה. התשובה היא, יש פה שיקולים מעשיים. מעבר לשיקולים המעשיים, אני מאמין שהבושם שלנו על ארץ ישראל הוא התנ"ך, ולפיכך הגבולות הם גבולות
תנ"כיים. רגע, אז עקרונית ארץ ישראל השלמה הגדולה?
עקרונית ארץ ישראל השלמה והגדולה והרחבה כמה שאפשר בגבולות הביטחון הישראלי ושינויי המדיניות הישראלית.
Zionism is based on the Bible, he says right there. That's your is that your liberal opposition in Israel, I guess? Anyway, let's talk about this issue of whether Jews are Zionists or not. Well, of course, one voice, which is a preeminent voice that many Jews are happy to have represent them, is Jonathan Greenblatt from the ADL. Let's check in what he has to say about this issue.
I am a ferocious, unapologetic Zionist. Every Jewish person is a Zionist.
I am so deeply connected to this place.
But every Saturday morning, like, you open your prayer book and it talks about Zion. It talks about Jerusalem.
By my family, by my sense of peoplehood.
Jews have been praying to Jerusalem for 2,000 years.
The historical reality of our Zionism. Like, you cannot take the Zionism out of Judaism.
Zionism is whether you're a religious Jew going to synagogue every day, or you're just a cultural Jew who even thinks of themselves as an atheist.
You cannot take the Zion out of the Jewish people.
Zionism is embedded in our tradition.
You can't go to a synagogue and find a siddur in any language, from any country, any level of observance, and find a page that doesn't mention Yerushalayim or Eretz Yisrael or Zion.
It's fundamental to our existence. Anti-Zionism is genocide.
Of course, he might be evil and a vampire, but he's not wrong. I think he's actually truthful here. Of course, the last comment is a vast exaggeration, of course, saying that being an anti-Zionist is genocide. But regardless, we get to talk about what Zion is then, right? Zion has, it's not what it originally meant, but it has become to mean utopia or heaven or paradise. Sometimes it's kind of analogous with the city of David, with a holy mountain, a haven. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, Jews don't believe in an afterlife, per se. So this is their kingdom. Now, the etymology of the term Zion, while its exact origin are debated, and some people think they have the answer to it, it likely derives from a Semitic root meaning stronghold or fortress. It might be related to the Arabic word sana, to protect, or dry land. There's also a non-Semitic root meaning river or brook. And there's an interesting thing about the water surrounding what becomes Jerusalem later. We'll talk about that. Zion is etymologically and conceptually related to the word sign or signpost, a marker or a landmark. It implies a raised place or a point that indicates direction, acting as a spiritual or physical destination. So it's a signpost, a sacred part of the land. Why? Because it's defensible. That's what it is. We'll talk about that here shortly. But the term, there's another related term called Tzaddik, which the Jews say is a righteous person, basically like a spiritual Superman, right? And Zion and Tzaddik is said to be related through Hebrew linguistics, including Jewish mysticism, the Kabbalah. It's like a kind of a spiritual interpretation of these types of things, where Tzaddik is viewed as the foundation, often a spiritual leader in Hasidim, who acts as a bridge between the divine and the physical world.
What does it mean that from Zion comes Torah? You know what it means? It means a country like the United States could not exist if there was no Zion. That's why the founding fathers called this country Zion. They saw it as the new promised land. Because a country like this, based on the Bill of Rights and based on the fact that all people are created equal and we have inalienable rights, comes straight out of the Torah.
I don't care!
So if you want to know what Zionism is, and look at the source, where does the word Zion come from? Does anyone here in this room know what the word Zion in Hebrew means? Zion? Most people think it means Israel. It means sign. Zion is a sign. In Hebrew you say letzayin means to mark something. As a matter of fact, the word Zion is sometimes used when you're talking about going to the holy site of a tzaddik. The Rebbe, in all his letters, he always, every letter ends, Asker al HaTzion. I'll mention this on the sign. The sign is the monument, the place where that marks the resting place of a tzaddik. But the point here is not the resting place, the point is the sign. A sign for what? As soon as you hear the word sign, what's a signpost? What is a signpost? It's indicating something. It's a sign of divinity. It's a place on earth where God says, here's a place that will remind you of me.
Now, of course, much of this is fairy tales and made up. Love the part, by the way, in the beginning when he talks about how America is like the Zion. The founding fathers didn't say that, but this reconstruction, right? A new land, kind of free from oppression and whatnot. Yeah, the Old Testament, it's kind of schizophrenic. The Old Testament is literally is talking about, like, exterminate these people, get rid of them. And then it's like, oh, well, it's where everyone is welcome and Bill of Rights and justice. And it's just, it's completely schizophrenic. But anyway, there's an interesting, let's dive into their schizophrenia. Let's dive into this neurosis, this concept that they have about God, and that they're the sole channelers of this, right? Obviously, it goes to this fact, too, that Norman Finkelstein won't recognize. And he talks about it later in that part of that interview that we showed, that they're chosen. Yeah, but why? By God. Okay, why they're chosen, they see themselves as supreme, better than everyone else. And he says that the Jews see themselves as better. Well, why? Because they're chosen, right? It's a delusion made up, where they think that God only is channeled through them and that he picked them as his special people. But anyway, mention the bridge between the divine and the physical world. Like, on this mountain, here is God, right? Zion. Here's God and nowhere else. But we also need that place because it's a geostrategic, defensible position. It relates to kind of a concept, right? Which is mentioned in the Bible as thy kingdom come, thy will be done. And the continuation of that is on earth as it is in heaven. On earth as it is in heaven. That's from the Lord's Prayer, and that's Matthew 6:10, expressing a desire for God's will or kingdom to be fully realized on earth just as it is in heaven. Now, side note here is kind of interesting. Matthew, I didn't know this before. He was actually known as Levi because most of the apostles were rabbis, right? They were Jews. But he was actually a tax collector in Capernaum who became one of the 12 apostles of Yeshua. And Matthew, his name was changed from Levi to Matthew, which means Yahweh's gift, when he became a follower of Yeshua or a Christian. He became a follower of a rabbinical, radical new tradition that they called the Way. This is Second Temple Judaism, right? But Matana, or Matt then, in his name, means gift in Hebrew. And Matthew, Yahweh, Matthew, Mat Yahu, right? Mat Yahuda, Matthew. Anyway, early Christians, known as the Way, began as a first century Jewish sect that was centered on Yeshua's teachings. He's emphasized a new creation, a new man. It's kind of interesting parallels with, like, what they try to do under Marxism and communism later on. Marx being a Jew too, kind of, I think, again, picking up a lot of these ideas about Jews as, you know, better than everyone else and all that stuff. But anyway, it was like a new it was like the Goyim are united as one blob, and we sit at the top, at the pinnacle of that, because we're chosen. So we're special. That's why they can have ethno-nationalism and everyone else can't, for example, right? But this new creation sprung out of this idea that it was erasing all the distinctions, national distinctions, racial distinctions, Jew and Gentile alike, right? Black, Asian, Hispanic, it doesn't matter. It's all in favor of having a new identity in their Messiah, in Yeshua. And it's rooted in Second Temple Judaism and early rabbinical traditions. It recognizes Yeshua as the promised Moshiach or Messiah, right? Kainos is his other term in Greek that they use, a new creation, a new man, essentially. Yeah, there's this passage, Galatians 3:28, where this is kind of mentioned. Anyway, let's go back to the point I mentioned earlier. On earth as it is in heaven. Interesting concept borrowed from an older concept out of Egyptian Hellenistic tradition, coming from Hermes Trismegistus, as above, so below. It's a Hermetic principle. Hermes, the thrice greatest, is a legendary Hellenistic figure that originated as a syncretic combination of the Greek god Hermes and the ancient Egyptian god Thoth. This amalgamation, right, of Greek, Hellenistic Greek tradition with Egyptian tradition, which, of course, a lot of the Jews at the time borrowed from, right? They were in that part of the world. These are political conflicts that they had at the time, existential conflicts, obviously, too. But so they kind of borrow that idea, right, of a hermetic idea that, like, as it is in heaven, we need to bring that to the earth. And therefore, the earth itself that they chose is heaven. Zion is heaven. That's the message here. And it's theirs. And it's only there that's sacred. And that's why divinity, if they're in charge of it, if they own this land, if they are in control of it, I guess, if it's their property promised to them by God, it's only divinity that can come through them, because they are the ones who are they're the ones who have access to that sacred mountain, right? So going back to Netanyahu a little bit here too, because he recently talked about the concept of reaching the kingdom. I'm not sure if you guys remember this. It's quite interesting. Securing the realm, that's what it reminded me of too. But listen here, here's Netanyahu.
And I believe we all recognize the fact that we will reach to the kingdom. We will make it to the return of the Messiah.
We will make it to the return of the Messiah. Nothing religious about this. Nothing Judaism about this. No, no, no. Of course not. It's just a political reasoned phenomena. It's all the British that are pushing this. No, no problem, guys. So it's a Kingdom of Israel, or the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom. Now, there is this interesting thread there of British Israelism. And, of course, you got to kind of, you have to take into account Freemasonry, which is like Judaism for the Goy, and a lot of these people around in that area, of course, were at that time weaved into this. But yes, they had a fascination for Hebrews because they were reading the Bible. The Jews are special, and they maybe even like, but we are also kind of Jews, or we can be part of that journey. And of course, through Freemasonic British Israeliteism, they could kind of like latch on to that to a certain extent. But regardless, there's no question of who was literally pulling the strings and for what reason, right? That anything else but that is a deflection, damage control. It's an outright lie, right? But let's go back to the point that you said about reaching the kingdom, because it reminded me of securing the realm. Do you guys remember this? The realm is another word of kingdom, right? Reich, Rike, regal, realm. These terms are all related, right? Securing the realm, securing the kingdom. Goes back to a clean break. Remember this? A new strategy for securing the realm, which was a policy document written up and prepared in 1996 by a neocon Jewish study group led by Jew Richard Perle, to be given to Benjamin Netanyahu. The report explained a new approach to solving Israel's security problems in the Middle East, with emphasis on Western values. That's what we hear so much about right now, obviously, with Israel as the defenders of the West and all that bullshit. The report was ultimately adopted and served as a foundation for modern-day Israeli global affairs. And what have we seen in the wake of the war on terror, the neocons as a disproportionate Jewish movement, of course, mass migrations of people from these countries where Israel are at war with and stated, because this is part of the Greater Israel Project. So when it was advantageous to push Britain to get what they wanted, they do that. Now it's America that is, slash, almost soon has been the leading superpower of the world, and that's where the main pressure now is by these Jews. Let's shift gears a little bit. Let's go back to another historical interesting place, which, of course, is Jerusalem in and of itself. And, of course, these are all very closely related here. Mount Zion, Mount Moriah, Jerusalem as the whole area of that, right? But Jerusalem comes from the word Jebusite for the Canaanite fortress that was located there. In other words, none of this, the city of David, Zion, all these things, none of that was actually built by Jews. It was not built by Israelis, Hebrews. All of these terms are flown around, but regardless of how you try to unravel this Gordian knot, today they all use them, and today they are all using these terms to achieve the goals that they want for this project of theirs. And again, from my point of view, this is a Gordian knot. We shouldn't even have to deal with these things, but unfortunately we do, right? So let's try to unravel it a little bit. So who were the Jebusite people? It was most likely an Amorite people. They were closely related to modern-day Lebanese people, genetically. These are actually the original Canaanites. Ancient DNA recovered from five Canaanite skeletons suggests that these people survived to contribute their genes to millions of people that are living today. About 50% of the Canaanites' genes come from local farmers who settled the Levant about 10,000 years ago. So that's kind of like, okay, now you got some claim on the land, right, if you want to go down that way. And then you have the other half that was linked to an earlier population identified from skeletons found in Iran. So this is like this Aryan invasion, Yamnaya, interesting thing here, right? So that's just what it is, right? All land have in some way been conquered, and you have different movements of people. But since we're talking about laying claim to the land and you know, well, Jews have a historical right to this land, and that's our ancient home. Oh, really? Yeah, well, let's look at the DNA evidence, what we have so far, right? So the other half was linked to an earlier population identified from skeletons found in Iran, which is the Aryans, basically, right? Researchers estimate these Eastern migrants arrived in the Levant and started mixing with locals around 5,000 years ago. Scientists compared their genomes to those of 99 living Lebanese people and hundreds of others in genetic databases. What was found was that the present-day Lebanese population is largely descended from the ancient Canaanites, inheriting more than 90% of their genes from this ancient source. Now, they claim as well, as like, well, some Jews also have that genetic lineage, and that's true, but that's only around 50 or so, and then they do have a European admixture. But what of course, what makes Jews interesting is that you can find them genetically, right? You can, even if it's Sephardim, Ashkenazim, all these different subgroups, right, of Jews. They are distinct genetically. They're not European, certainly not. And they're also not fully Levantine or Canaanite, right? And I don't think it's just due to the mix that you can have them stand out. There is a distinct genetic trait there. But regardless, they have less claim to that land than the Lebanese people do. That's what I found interesting about these genetic studies. Palestinian people derive about 80% of their genome from ancient Canaanites. So back to Jerusalem, or Jebus, as it actually was called. Yes, it was actually called Jebus. The Jebusites built Jebus. David is said to have conquered Jebus around 1000 or 1010 BCE or so. And again, this is according to the Bible, what we're getting to here next. So take this with a large grain of kosher salt, okay? But let's just take what they are pushing in the Hebrew Bible. So this is, you know, by the way, then some 400 to 500 years when David is said to have conquered Jebus, an established existing settlement, which later becomes Jerusalem or City of David, all that stuff, right? So this is about 400 to 500 years after some of the first books of the Bible are even have said to be written. The oldest biblical texts known, such as the Dead Sea Scrolls, are copies dating much later, between 250 BCE and maybe around 100 CE or so. It's hard to know, right? So who knows how old it actually is? I think it's based on myths, and there's certain things that are true in there, but this is the same thing. Like, many times when you go through this material, it's like, well, it is accurately describing, you know, this temple or what this well in this area in Babylon or so. You know, there's things like that, right? And so then they take those as historical facts. But this would be like saying, like, well, I can write about why I went to a NASCAR race, and I can write about the stadium and give you the but I can lie about who won the race. Do you see how this works? It's like you realize that they write, they make up. This is your first Hollywood movie right here, and they write things to say certain things happened when they didn't, in order to lay claim on them. And maybe there was an understanding of this at the time, like they could literally watch Babylon, Egypt, and stuff. Like, they write things. This is history. This is what it is. And they're like, okay, well, we got to have our own, so let's just make it then, or something. Who knows how that actually unfolded? but there's enough plot holes here in the story. This holy story has a lot of holes in it. The Jebusites built and occupied the city of Jebus, which is ancient Jerusalem, during the early Bronze Age, with estimates suggesting the site was established as early as 3200 BCE, 3200 BCE. And they occupied this for basically almost 1,000 years. And after that time, maybe 800 years to 1,000 years. And over that time, they transform it into a well-fortified Canaanite city. So around 2500 or so, or, you know, 2000 BCE. At that point, it was like kind of established, right? And it was referred to as Yabusu on certain tablets dating to around 2200 BCE, 2200 BCE, serving as a stronghold until King David is said to have captured it around 1000 BCE. So they've been holding it for 2,000 years. The Canaanites have occupied that area when David is said to come in and say, God told us that this we need this, we were given this place. So we're going to genocide you and take it from you, and now it's our ancient homeland. That's literally what happened here when you look at the history. Again, this is through a biblical lens. But when you start comparing it with archaeological finds and then look at this group and what they said is to have taken place, it's not looking good, all right? So how did the Jews or Israelites conquer Jebus or this Jebusite city? Watch.
David decides that Jerusalem, positioned at the heart of the Israelite territory, will be the capital of his kingdom. But Jerusalem is a powerful and intimidating Canaanite city, and until David's time, no tribe has been able to conquer it. Now, once again, confident of their fortifications, the Jebusites take up positions on the city walls. The young King David challenges the complacent enemy. He is determined. This time, Jerusalem must fall.
אני עומד על המדרון המזרחי של עיר דוד. כאן בשנת 1995 מצאו ארכיאולוגים פרופסור רוני רייך ואלי שוקרון שרידים של מגדל ענק שנבנה על ידי הכנענים לפני כ-4,000 שנה. האבנים האלה, שכל אחת מהן שוקלת מספר רב של טונות, הן חלק ממגדל עצום שנבנה ממש כאן בסמוך למעיין הגיחון. דוד מבין שבדרכים מקובלות הוא לא יצליח לכבוש את העיר. פה צריך לחשוב מחוץ לקופסה.
He promises the esteemed position of head of the army to the soldier who dares to volunteer for this dangerous mission and succeeds. One man rises to the challenge, Joab ben Tseruya, a tough and daring soldier. In his challenge, David uses two mysterious words, Veiga Batsinor. What is this tsinor that David is referring to? Thousands of years later, a fascinating discovery was made, shedding light on the mysterious tsinor. In 1867, the archaeologist Captain Charles Warren crawled through a tunnel near the Gihon Spring. About 20 meters from the spring, Warren discovered a vertical shaft that rose to a height of 13 meters above his head. With great effort, Warren climbed to the top of the shaft, where, to his amazement, he discovered that the tunnel continued to rise steeply until it reached the city above.
Warren הבין מיד שלפניו מפעל מים סודי שנבנה לפני אלפי שנים. התכנון היה מתוחכם ביותר. הכנענים ידעו שנקודת התורפה של איראן היא המעיין שנמצא מחוץ לחומות העיר.
They build a great citadel around the spring and dug a tunnel down from the city above to the citadel surrounding the spring.
David מגלה את מפעל המים הקדום. זה הצינור.
He sends Joab ben Tseruya through this tunnel to infiltrate the city. After Job exits the tunnel, he runs down to the city gates. The Jebusite soldiers fail to notice him. Job reaches the city gates and opens them with great force. Before the Jebusites can grasp what has happened, David's soldiers burst through the gates and take the city by surprise. But David captured the fortress of Zion, which is the city of David.
Well, 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 tunnel dwellers, huh? Through the water systems. Interesting. I wonder if something else happened there. Maybe they didn't conquer it. Maybe they poisoned the water. Who knows? But it's like, look, you can't trust anything. It's an interesting story. I mean, I think they killed a lot of people. That's true. I mean, this is not the only place they conquered. Conquest, genocide, territory by territory. At least they claim they did these things. You do have that as a variable here, too. Maybe they wrote down that they did these things. They actually didn't do those things. I mean, there's something, obviously, up until like when the Romans conquer the second destroy the second temple and they're dispersed, and unfortunately Roman Empire allowed them to come in, but they forbade them from going to Jerusalem to kind of humiliate them and lock them out of their religious center. So something obviously happened here. I'm not going to say that it's like they don't even exist or it's all frauds, Khazars or something. I don't believe in that for a moment. But I'm saying we can't even the claim that they say that they have on the ancient land. We don't know if they actually conquered all of this, those areas. And they have enough Canaanite DNA apparently themselves. Now, there's something different there. There's a different component, but they have enough Canaanite that it's kind of plausible that it's like it's kind of this, it's the same population. Goes interesting to this idea of the Habiru in Egyptians, which was translated to marauders, which later is believed to become Hebrew. But that was a collection. They were all kind of like Canaanite, but it was literally like the most criminal mafia, organized, outsiding, marauding criminal network that became identified with the Hebrews. It was like a reject Canaanite population in and of itself. All these kinds of ideas, right? Speculations. But they conquered territory by territory, they claim. Akko, Ashapa, Alijon, Ashkelon, Beth Shehan, Gezer, we'll talk about that a little bit later. Gebal or Byblos, Hatzor, Hebron, Jerusalem or Jebus, Lachish, Medigo, Sechem, Shiloh, Sidon or Sidon. All these areas they conquered, apparently. It wasn't theirs. And it wasn't there for thousands of years. But now they're telling us that this is their historical ancient homeland and they ran it first and we controlled it first. It's not true. If you don't actually control it, if you lose your land, was it really yours? The Israelites were commanded by God in the Old Testament to completely destroy or drive out the Jebusites, along with several other Canaanite nations. This command was intended to prevent the Israelites from adopting the abominable pagan practices, including child sacrifice associated with these groups. Now, while early excavations at Tel Gezer initially suggested, and we'll talk about Gezer more later, but I looked into this a little bit. At Tel Gezer, it initially suggested the presence of human sacrifice. And then you have more modern excavations where analysis had largely overturned these conclusions. So you did have a high child mortality rate, and if they placed the bones of these kids in urns, then it was like later we found them as, oh, that's clearly child sacrifice.
These 10 standing stones date to the Middle Bronze Period and were originally suggested by archaeologists to be the site of child sacrifice here at Gezer. This assumption has since been largely rejected due to a lack of evidence, but we're still not completely sure what they actually were. The current leading hypothesis, that of William Deaver, is that they were erected to commemorate an alliance between Gezer and several other local groups here in the area.
The Hinnom Valley, Hinnom or Gehenna, which is located south of Jerusalem's or Jebusite's old city, is a historically dark site, infamous for ancient child sacrifices to Moloch, and as a burning trash dump. This is where it's become synonymous with hell, right? Gehenna is hell later. Anyway, the Bible refers to the Topet in the Valley of Hinnom as a place where children were sacrificed by fire. It's mentioned in 2 Kings 23, Jeremiah 19, and many believe that it was a place of filth and death. Archaeologists have, however, not discovered mass children graves there, or direct physical evidence of infant sacrifice in the Hinnom Valley itself, which is kind of interesting. So did they make this up? Is this on par with Hamas put children in ovens to justify killing them? Do you see what I'm saying? Now, in many regards, even them themselves, like King Solomon, later on reverts back to the pagan traditions. It is true that there's a Canaanite ancient world core, obviously, to even the Israelis and what later becomes Jews, right? Now, Carthage is a different thing. That seems to be a little bit different. This is like in modern-day Tunis or Tunisia. Carthage likely engaged in child sacrifice. But that's North Africa. That's kind of far away. You can kind of, Carthage was kind of like a multicultural cesspool, to be honest, with a lot of different people. There were some Canaanites, but, Punics and Libyans and, all kinds of things. It was like a multiracial mess, it seems like. But Carthage likely engaged in child sacrifice, specifically offering young children and infants to deities like Baal Hamon and Tanit. From the city's founding in the 9th century BCE until its destruction by Rome in 146 BCE. And that's also interesting about the archaeological finds, because that's later. When they claim that these people are engaging in human sacrifices, or child sacrifices specifically, there are human sacrifices, we should say that. But in many regards, those sacrifices, that was the same as like the Celts and the Druids. The Romans, oh my God. They were literally killing criminals, murderers, gangsters, foreign outsiders or invaders, things like this, right? Their justice system was weaved into a religious ceremonial practice at the same time. So as you punished your enemies and those who were undesirables, who were unfit to live in their society, they were also a gift back to the gods, right, kind of thing. The Carthage thing is much later than when the Jews, the Israelites at the time, claimed that all these other human sacrifices, and specifically child sacrifices, is going on. So there's a discrepancy in the timeline, if the timeline is correct. Evidence from excavation of Tophets, which is infant burial sites, show thousands of urns containing remains with the practice, while debated, commonly interpreted as religious rite to gain favor or divine favor during crises, right? So this is very similar to like what you allegedly see in, South American cultures and stuff like that. Harvest goes bad, shit goes bad, they're all freaking out, we're all going to die. Superstition, what do? We got to give the thing we cherish the most, right? Which is our kids. That's what we got to do. And so that seems to have been going on there. But here's another remarkable contradictory story, which you can't really make heads or tails of. The threshing floor of Arunda the Jebusite. This was a site on Mount Moria, which is just adjacent to Mount Zion. They're all kind of in the same area. Mount Moria, that's where the threshing floor of Arunda the Jebusite, so the Jerusalemite, was, but he was purchased by King David to build an altar there in order to halt a divine plague. This is in 2 Samuel 24. And it's this weird, like, he did some an illicit census. This is weird, like, anyway. None of this have to make sense. This is their concept of God. These people are actually not channeling God. You can argue what that is, what that was. But these people either came up with something, if they're even historical people, or it's just made up later. But regardless, they didn't trust the plan enough. That's basically, he didn't trust the plan, so there's a plague. And of course, these are reconstructions, right? After the fact, it's like, oh, there's a plague. Oh, shit, I did something wrong. What did I do? It has to be this, right? Like plague disease, shit happened, right? But this is the ancient world, lots of superstition. I get it. Look, it's fine. But now it's interpreted in the modern political era that this is our land. Look at these guys. It's all true. So it serves as the historic, divinely designated location for Solomon's temple, this threshing floor of Arunda, the Jebusite, symbolizing mercy, atonement, and the transition of the site to Israelite ownership. So it says, I was a divine plan. We were meant to have it, so give it to me. And that was, by the way, around the year 1000 or so BC. when he buys it. And it's a contradiction in terms. Arunda Djebusai is like, oh, you could totally have it, bro. I get you gotta stop the plague or whatever. It doesn't save the... So the plague apparently inflicted the Israelites. But it's unclear whether it afflicted the Jebusites as well, which is... who knows? I don't know. But for some reason, the Jebusite is just like, sure, bro, you can totally have it. And King David was like, nah, I'm going to pay you a lot more for it than you actually do because I'm that guy. I'm just really cool. It was like 600 gold shekel or something. There's a contradiction in terms of the price that he paid for the threshing floor. But anyway, he builds an altar there in order to sacrifice, right? And that apparently then stops the plague. But that's Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah. Just adjacent to Zion. It's all around the Jebusite area, Jerusalem. Abraham, by the way, went to Canaanite-controlled Mount Moriah in 1900 BC. So that's 900 years earlier, according to the Bible. So take these with a big grain of kosher salt here, these timelines here. But I'm saying, let's just hear them out. King David is getting this, buying this area so that they can start, this is going to be the future foundation for the temple, right? But 900 years earlier than that, Abraham goes to Canaanite-controlled at that time. There's no Israelites there at that point. It's all Canaanites, right? It's controlled by them. He goes to this Mount Moriah spot in order to sacrifice his son Isaac. Abraham did not stay at Mount Moriah. Canaanites were there, so he returned back to Beersheba. The Israelites did not control Mount Moriah or Jerusalem when Abraham went to sacrifice Isaac. There's almost 1,000 years, apparently, then between these events. And then almost 500 years later, after Abraham does his thing, that's when Joshua and Caleb went to go to Canaan, land of Canaan, to spy on behalf of Moses, essentially. Apparently to like scout out the area to check where they wanted to ethnically cleanse the Canaanites so that they could take all these areas from them. So it's like almost 2,000, then it's 1,500, and then it's year thousands. So this is like 1,000-year period where they don't have control of the area. They don't have access to it. It's all Canaanites there. They're not controlling any of this. So that's not a timeline you can say, oh, they were there for 1,000. No, they literally like go in and out as spies. So about 450 years later, almost 500 years later, according to the Bible, King Solomon then builds the first temple on Mount Moriah in Jerusalem, beginning around 966 BC. Who knows about these timelines? This site is explicitly identified in 2 Chronicles 3:1 as a location where God appeared to David, specifically on the threshing floor of Arunda, the Jebusite, as we said earlier, which is believed to be the same mount where Abraham prepared to sacrifice Isaac. So it's 500 years between these events. All land is ultimately conquered land. Right? No one sprung up from the earth anywhere. People have moved. Someone always fought someone in order to get it. But what's interesting here with the Zionists is that they have this idea that they get to do a redo here. Back up. Actually, in this period, right here, that's when we gonna return to now. Is that true for anyone else? And why? Because they wrote the book, or the books themselves, about their neurotic concepts of God, who, you know, where they wrote down and say, yeah, we're totally special. I was in communication with the big guy, and he told me, the real estate guy told me, I can have that piece of land. And we're special, and he gave it to us. So that's where we're going to hone it. We're doing a redo and getting that back. So there's an interesting point here now of like how this ties into modern-day Zionism, and why this area is still so important in terms of trade. And it reminded me of this old clip. Now, there was an old lecture that good old Jordan Maxwell did back in the day. And I couldn't find that exact one, unfortunately, but he has a retelling of it where he explains why this piece of land, the real estate in of itself, is so important.
So if you go to the top of Russia and draw a straight line to the Gold Coast of West Africa, right on the Atlantic Ocean, and draw a straight line from England to India. Now you've crisscrossed the greatest landmass on the earth, from Russia to Africa, from England to India. And where does it crisscross? Where does it cross?
Israel.
It crosses right in Israel. Any business that's going to be conducted in the world, from Russia and China and India, England, Europe, Africa, any business, is all going to go through Israel.
That's true back then, and it's true today, right? Historically and geographically, Israel served as a vital land bridge connecting Africa, Asia, and Europe. Positioned between the Mediterranean Sea and the Arabian Desert, it acted as a crucial crossroads for ancient trade. And in addition, the King's Highway, something called the King's Highway, which is connecting major empires like Egypt, Mesopotamia, and Anatolia. King's Highway is kind of interesting. They're talking about extending that as well down to Pharaoh's Highway as well. The route of the King's Highway is today in Jordan. But of course, that's part of the area that they claim that they are going to control through the Greater Israel Project. And it goes right to the east of the Dead Sea Transform Fault, essentially. That was also part of, back in the day, I believe, of why they wanted to control it. They saw this wealth pass through here. They saw that as a fertile area, as important area. This is, at the time, a geostrategic thing, but it was framed as God told us that we can have it. It's not just claiming it for the sake of claiming it. It's coming up with a moral and spiritual justification of why they should have it. Maybe that's to convince themselves, but probably not. It's probably more to convince everyone else around them. Who knows? But the new King's Highway now is interesting because it is literally going through Israel. And of course, the greater Israel that they have, the more control of these things they will have. The oil is going to go through there. All the cyber or, you know, AI tech is in Tel Aviv now, essentially. Big agriculture development, big pharma development, genetics, all these companies in Tel Aviv, all of the big Silicon Valley firms have basically R&D developments in Tel Aviv as well. They're a financial hub, they're a trade hub, and Jerusalem is basically like the religious hub. That's going to be the high seat of the UN, and that's where Yahweh and the Moshiach are going to rule over everyone else with the Noah, you know, who under Noahide law. But Netanyahu has now said that he wants oil and gas to flow through Israel post the Iran war.
I think that what has to be done is to have alternative routes. Instead of going through the choke points of the Hormuz Straits and the Bab el-Mandeb Straits in order to have the flow of oil, just have oil pipelines, gas pipelines, going west through the Arabian Peninsula, right up to Israel, right up to our Mediterranean ports, and you've just done away with the choke points for forever.
And that's part of the plan. That's what they want. They want to be the ruler of this world because that's what the God told them to do. Zionism is Judaism, and Judaism is Zionism. Let's go back to another area. Gezer was established as a major Canaanite city-state during the early Bronze Age with initial occupation around 3500 or so BCE. It became a heavily fortified urban center during the Middle Bronze Age, around the year 2000 or maybe 1500 BCE. According to the Book of Joshua, Joshua defeated Horam, the king of Gezer, and his army when they came to aid Lachish, taking place around the 13th or 15th century, 1300, 1500 BCE, depending on, again, biblical chronology here, obviously. So much later, Joshua defeats the king of Gezer and his army, but then they don't take it or they don't claim it or occupy it or whatever. Gezer was another one of these important trading places, right? An ancient cultural seat, essentially. And there's standing stones there. There's some interesting things there for sure. Old Canaanite settlements, right? But then later in the story, and this is, what is that, 300 to 500, depending on the chronology here, then 300 to 500 years later, King Solomon is then given Gezer. Why does he need to be given Gezer if Joshua defeated the king of Gezer and his army to take it over. So he defeats them, but they leave it or something. Then and the Canaanites continue to occupy it. I don't know. It's contradictory. Strange. But King Solomon was given Gezer as a dowry, or as a wedding gift by an unnamed Egyptian pharaoh, who captured, burnt, and destroyed the Canaanite city sometime in the mid-10th century, around the year 1000 or so. And then the gift is said to have occurred around 970 BC. Oh, here you go. You're going to marry. And of course, it's because Egypt at the time controlled all these city-states. They were Canaanites. They were like vassal states of Egypt, right? But anyway, how many years is between Joshua and Solomon then? Approximately 480 years elapsed between the exodus from Egypt and the fourth year of Solomon's reign. That's a long time. So did they occupy Gezer or not? Gezer became a major fortified Canaanite city-state in the first half of the second millennium BCE. It was later destroyed by fire and rebuilt. It was first mentioned in several ancient Egyptian inscriptions. It's important. The Amarna letters mention a lot about Gezer, and they're complaining on the Hapiru attacks, the marauding Hebrews, right? Things like this. And they're asking for assistance or whatever. And who knows? Maybe they are the ones who take over later on in Egypt, because all of a sudden, Egyptian pharaoh comes up, sacks Gezer, and supposedly gives it to King Solomon, if any of that is even true. It was later destroyed by fire and rebuilt. It was first mentioned in several ancient Egyptian inscriptions. It's important. It was due to the strategic position that it held at the crossroads of an ancient coastal trade route linking Egypt with Syria, Anatolia, and Mesopotamia, and the road to Jerusalem, or Jebusite, and Jericho, both important trade routes. So you have this. Back in the day, this was about controlling trade and mercantilism and money and flow of goods and being a third party in trade, one who handles distribution, things like this, right? You see where this is going? You see what this is? Anyway, here's Via Maris, right, in purple. The road of the sea, and then you have the king's road in red. Three Israelite cities stood in prominent locations along the Via Maris: Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. And again, they were not in Israelite control for probably 2,000 years. They'd been occupied thousands of years, even before that, by people who preceded the Canaanites. Gezer had further strategic importance because it stood at the intersection of the Via Maris and an east-west road that headed towards Jericho. This trade route dates back to the early Bronze Age, about 3000 BCE. This system of commerce and trade was operational in the ancient world for well over 1,000 years, possibly closer to 2,000 years, before the Jews dreamt up that they had been given this very important land by their god, Yahweh. The Romans controlled Jerusalem for about 700 years. So why not give back Jerusalem to them? They controlled it basically as long as the Jews did after they took it from the Canaanites. The entire layout and design of the old city in Jerusalem is entirely designed by Romans. What you see when you go to the old city of Jerusalem is for the most part all Roman. And of course, there's obviously as prior settlements there, as I said, Jebusites, Canaanites, obviously, right? But Romans leveled it. They leveled Jerusalem after the Roman-Jew war, after the Bar Kokhba revolt and all that, and they destroyed their second temple. They just razed it all to the ground, burned it down, and then they built it as a Roman city, the Aelia Capitolina. That's what they named it. And it was in their control for about 700 years before it was lost to the Muslims. And that was largely because the Roman Empire had weakened at that point, and you had other political disputes, and they couldn't hold it anymore, right? So the Muslims took it over at that point. And I believe, by the way, that the Muslims let the Jews back in Jerusalem as well. The Romans had this idea that if we can cut them off kind of like spiritually, like if they consider this land, this piece of property, as their spiritual high seat, let's decapitate that. Now, unfortunately, of course, it was a diaspora then of Jews after the Second Temple fell, and they allowed them to be in the Roman Empire. Maybe they shouldn't have, but anyway, the history, it's what it is now. But yes, they build a temple to Jupiter. and other such glorious things in Jerusalem. So you can say they returned it back to pagan, you know, Canaanite traditions. And then you realize the Israelites themselves, of course, stem from pagans and all their celebrations and stuff. But anyway. But, you know, you can give it back to the Romans, or you can give it back to the Lebanese then. I mean, again, give it back to the group that disproportionately have, I guess, blue eyes today then. The first came into the region about, what is it, 6,000 years ago, right? All these interesting genetic science, and again, there's obviously an Aryan incursion into the area. But by that standard, by the standard that Jews seeks to set by saying that this land, Canaan, belongs to them, also justifies Europeans to not only conquer and take back Constantinople, modern-day Istanbul, but even Göbekli Tepe itself. We can take back the Iranian plateau, because that's really where Aryans from, well, Pontic Steppe, I guess, it depends on where you think the Yamnaya is from or whatever. But again, if we use these same standards, where does one stop? And what period, what slice in history do we revert back to? That's why this is an illegitimate claim. And that's why this point of Norman Finkelstein, to go back to that initial interview that he did and the clip that we played, that he has not even studied Judaism, is a absolute joke, an absolute farce in terms of going to him as any kind of authority on the issue. I think he's a gatekeeper. I think he's intentionally probably lying to make sure that it doesn't end up where he doesn't want it to end up, because ultimately it seems like he has an ethnic allegiance like they all do. Case in point, let's go back to the interview. It turns out that this conversation that they had in the beginning started over Tucker Carlson's recent expose of Israel and Zionism. And it turns out that Finkelstein doesn't like the fact that Jews are seen, or he claims that Trucker is trying to present the picture that Jews are international string pullers. Listen.
Many things Tucker Carlson has said, many things that he said over the past year are correct. They're accurate. He played a crucial role in bringing his understanding in order to bring it before a large audience. The problem is, he frames the whole issue as, here is this innocent, pure United States that has been tricked, duped, seduced, blackmailed, and that's an important aspect of their claim, that's been blackmailed by these Jews in Israel. And that's how Palestine became an issue of the left, a national liberation struggle, a struggle against imperialism, one of the last struggles against European colonialism, akin to the South Africa question. That's how the left frames it. I think the right frames it as Jews, wire pullers, international wire pullers, who now control, and actually have for a long time, according to these people, they were responsible, they meaning the Jews in Israel, were responsible for the Kennedy assassination. They blamed the 2003 war in Iraq on the Jews in Israel. And the bottom line is that the Jewish question, historically, in the hands of the right, has never had a particularly happy outcome. Jews have not fared well in the right. I think everybody can agree on that.
But what I would say is, first of all, I would argue that Tucker is very careful to make a difference, but he doesn't say the Jews. He really doesn't.
Claims of, I'm not really talking about all the Jews. It's sort of like Lady Macbeth protesting too much. He knows exactly what he's doing, and he knows exactly the message he's conveying. And the more he protests that he's not making that message, the more he's clearly making that message. So he says, well, I know it was Israel that was behind the 2003 war in Iraq, and there are these people in this country who have a dual loyalty. They have really their loyalty is really to Israel, and they don't care about the United States. And now he says that Israel dragged the U.S. into the war because it wanted to weaken the United States, because Israel wants an alliance with India. Where he came up with that, only God knows, I have to say.
Oh, boy. Oh, my gosh. Where does one even begin with any of that? Okay, first of all, complete lie. See how he frames it the same way. Israeli Jewish Zionism is European colonialism. See? When land and territory is occupied in Western white European countries by migrants driven out of their homelands by Jewish wars, then it's not occupation. When it's DEI policies against white people, that's not oppression. See how this works? It's a complete lie, complete fabrication, complete obfuscation of the reality of the issue. While he's denying the disproportionate involvement of Jews among the neocons that push for the war in Iraq and Syria and Lebanon and in Libya and now Iran, which he denies as well. We'll get to that, but it's just, where do you even begin? Tucker Carlson is not making the claim that Jews are international string pullers. I wish. But he's not, okay? Let's talk about the Iran war. This is what Rubio said when it was popping off.
So the president made the very wise decision. We knew that there was going to be an Israeli action. We knew that that would precipitate an attack against American forces. And we knew that if we didn't preemptively go after them before they launched those attacks, we would suffer higher casualties and perhaps even higher those killed. And then we would all be here answering questions about why we knew that and didn't.
So they were dragged into it. And in fact, Israeli TV was lamenting the issue over the fact that he was admitting to this fact afterwards.
Meanwhile, Marco Rubio, in possibly the most damaging comment for Israel yesterday, said that the Israelis were planning an attack, and the Americans felt that if they didn't preemptively strike Iran, that the Americans would be hit as a result of Israel's strike on Iran, which puts Israel in a really tough spot right now, and Israel supporters here at home essentially being used as fodder by Israel critics to say that Jerusalem is controlling Washington's foreign policy. So
a real messaging issue right now. Yeah, of course, Israel is not controlling Washington's policy. Of course not. That's why, was it Patrick Buchanan who called Capitol Hill as occupied territory, Israeli occupied territory? So is that why the State Department, just literally a few days ago, 21st of April, under Operation Epic Fury and International Law, written by Reed Rubenstein, legal advisor, quote, said that, quote, the United States is engaged in this conflict at the request of and in the collective self-defense of its Israeli ally. Well, there you have it, written in black and white. But it's how can Norman Finkelstein, an academic, claim such a ridiculous thing, like that there's no validity to the fact that America was dragged into the war by Israel? Clearly, he's just, look, I could probably make this video 20 seconds long, 2 seconds long, and say Norman Finkelstein is fake and gay. And there, boom, over. Or something. He's a liar. The other thing Finkelstein said was this issue about India. Let's have a quick look at some of the headlines here. Laura Trump speaks at the first American Hindu Jewish gala. What now? Benjamin Netanyahu welcomes India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi as he arrived in Tel Aviv on Wednesday for a two-day visit. Bolstering bilateral ties, technology, water management, agriculture. This is not something pulled out of the air. In a world where anti-Semitism is rising, Netanyahu said, India stands out. A civilization where Jews were never persecuted by the state, only welcomed. The Israeli Knesset erupts in a synchronized clapping and Modi chants as India's Modi prepares to speak before the Knesset. Prime Minister of India Modi tells the Israeli government that Jews and Hindus are directly connected to each other from the Talmud. Modi says the Jewish community in India is one of them. The Talmud records trade with India in ancient times. Israel's new greatest ally, India. Netanyahu after losing support in the U.S. and Germany, it's now touting Israel's alliance with India. In India, Israel is enormously popular, Netanyahu said. Is this just made up? There's nothing to this claim. He's just an old boomer. He doesn't know what's going on. Modi went to the Holocaust Remembrance Center, like all these things, right? Worshipping the flowers. That was kind of funny. Is Israel hedging against the uncertainty in its alliance with the U.S.? Former foreign policy advisor to President Trump, George Papadopoulos. Oh, he follows me? That's interesting. Okay. He tells Matt Gaetz that the Israelis may rely on allies like India in the future as public opinion towards Israel in Western countries, especially among young people, sours. Let's watch.
I think that the Israelis now ultimately understand that their future is going to be more aligned with countries like India. They signed a recent massive trade agreement with India. They have a very close collaboration in intel and military with India. So I think the Israelis recognize that the trends are not in their favors. They're looking at alternatives, and massive countries like India will likely be where the Israelis look towards in the future.
Yeah, nothing. Where is he even getting these? Where is Tucker Carlson getting this idea from, that there's some type of India alliance here? What's possibly going on here? He's just an outdated boomer, Finkelstein. It's amazing. He's some kind of academic. He's a front. He's an embarrassment and a front there to do damage control to ensure that real criticism of Jews doesn't take it where they don't want it to go. This is classic procedure. But speaking of the unreliable partner that the U.S. apparently is becoming for Israel, even Ben Shapiro himself joined in on this issue. Listen.
Would you describe the U.S. as a good ally right now?
I think that the U.S. has always been an unreliable ally, shall we say.
After billions of dollars, countless aids, number of wars initiated on behalf of Israel from America, it's always been an unreliable ally. And what's the reason for that? Well, Mr. I don't care about the browning of America, Ben Shapiro, has now lamented with the fact that as America is becoming browner, the Israel support is waning. Listen.
Hasan Piker grew up in Istanbul, Turkey. Zoran Mamdani spent his early childhood in Uganda and South Africa. Ilhan Omar grew up in Somalia. These people hate America. They should love it. They hate it. Clearly. They're all from the third world. All of these are major political figures on the left. In fact, realistically, they are the new leading core of the Democratic Party. We have been importing the people who hate our country and wish to destroy it, who believe in third worldism, the philosophy that all the problems of all the third world can be laid at the feet of us here in the West. But there's more. The people in the Democratic Party elite who apparently believe that the West owes it to the third world to destroy itself, or who see the third worldists as fellow travelers helping them to accomplish that goal. Bernie Sanders and Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, Ezra Klein in the New York Times, the Pod Save America bros. These people could cast out the radicals. They could fight them in favor of a conversation with those of us who love America. Instead, they choose to side with those who despise the country in order to defeat us.
Well, that's probably because, well, the leftists don't recognize this. They just see Israel as a white European colonialist in the vein of Norman Finkelstein. But that's why that position is the weaker position to take. So, yes, Ben Shapiro, we tried to tell you. The people on the right tried to tell you this, but did you listen? No. And now the alliance is, if it even is such a thing, and that could be argued that it's not and it's never going to work or whatever, but at least in terms of like the, what is the priority here? Because Ben Shapiro will never recognize the disproportionate influence of Jews in helping to open America's borders, opening the borders of Europe, making it more brown, letting in the Muslims, changing these voting patterns and the tradition of looking favorably towards Israel. And, I mean, again, we can't control it, so it is what it is, but I'm just saying, like, yeah, we know. But of course, he has a backup country to go to. He can always go back to Israel. But anyway, so you have this whole thing with, like, Finkelstein not being able to understand any of this, essentially. And either claiming that he's ignorant of the issue, or I guess at this point even a refusal just to look into the issue, because even at face value, it would be ridiculous to suggest such a thing. Check this out. Here's Finkelstein explaining what he claims a Zionist actually is then?
Zionism, in my opinion, basically can come down to a simple proposition. A Zionist believed there was no future for Jews in the non-Jewish world. Some believed that Jews would end up assimilating and they would just become, for all intents and purposes, and sometimes literally, not sometimes, often literally, if they intermarried, that they would just become goys. And the Jewish people and the Jewish religion would disappear. And the other view was that the Jews would not be assimilated, they would be exterminated. That at some point, the temperature of anti-Semitism, which always hovered at a high temperature, but at some point it would result in a mass extermination of Jews. And so there being no future for Jews in the non-Jewish world, Jews needed to establish a state, and they thought the state should be established in their historic homeland as they saw it, namely Eretz Israel or Palestine. That's a Zionist. And there was a social critic, his name was Irving Howe, but he once made a statement which I found sensible. He said, if you have enough money in your pocket to buy a one-way ticket to Israel, and you don't do it, then you're not a Zionist. They're not Zionists. I don't know why people use this terminology. I do believe that they're Jewish supremacists. And their sense of community with the Jews in Israel is born of the fact not that they're Zionists, but because they feel a sense of commonality with fellow Jews, and that sense of commonality is a Jewish supremacist one. Jews grow up with one thought hammered into their heads from birth. Jews are better. Jews are better. I grew up with it because that was I grew up in an old Jewish neighborhood. And these were the whiz kids, very smart for sure. And we did believe that Jews are better.
Yeah, but why, right?
Why?
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 Because
why?
They're considering themselves to be chosen. It's a religious thing. In terms of IQ, there are other groups that are smarter or borderline on average. They are certainly better at finagling and elbowing their way into things, but apparently they're not blackmailing, as he clarified earlier. They don't engage in any kind of subversive tactics or operate like a criminal cartel or a network that benefiting each other. You can't say that. That's wrong. But somehow they're supremacist and they see themselves as chosen. They also want to, you know, continue their existence somehow. All those things are recipes, right? That actually explains why they act the way they do. And then the fact that there is a genetic component to that. But I think he's just obfuscating from that very point, right? But if they don't go, his point there, why don't they go to Israel? If they were Zionists, they would just leave and go to Israel. No, that's not how it works. The way it works, and either he's dumb or he's dishonest. Take your pick. But that's not how it works. How this works is to be inside of and operate inside of the most powerful, superpower nation that you can at the time to get benefits from it, to use it. Here's Ben Shapiro, for example, being asked, well, why don't you leave? Listen to his answer.
Do you ever wonder if one day you'll have to flee the United States?
I mean, I think that every Jew throughout world history who has a brain and knows history has always wondered if a country that is not a Jewish state is going to eternally provide them security guarantees and full citizenship, of course. I mean, that's why the existence of the State of Israel is the single greatest guarantor of my loyalty to the United States, frankly. Right? Because Israel exists, that means the United States is going to be a more welcoming place for me, because Israel is there as a backstop in case anything should go wrong.
Why won't you make Aliyah to the State of Israel?
Thank you. Because the fundamental principles of the United States are good, eternally good, and worth upholding. And my fight to do that as a Jew is deeply important, not just to people who are not Jewish, but particularly to Jews. So in other words, my Jewish mission does not conflict with my presence in the United States or my citizenship in the United States or my loyalty to the United States.
Shouldn't Jews live in the state of Israel?
Shouldn't all Jews live in the state of Israel?
All the Jews.
Jews should live where they can do the most, where they can be a light to the nations. And for me, as a person with millions and millions of followers in the United States, promoting what I think are values that are eternally good, living in the United States is a point of I think, morality for me.
Ben Shapiro alone is evidence that Norman Finkelstein is wrong. Here he's saying that he wants to be in America because it influences America. He can influence Americans in order to support Israel. In other words, the mission is Israel, but you do it from a different country in order to change it, take advantage of it, get wealthy from it, and then you use those means and resources or political pressure in that country to support your home country. Here he is even asking for donations for the IDF on his show.
Friends of the IDF is providing, people need Kevlar, they need helmets, they're short of basic supplies. Friends of the IDF helps provide resources. So here are five ways you can help. Friends of the IDF, FIDF.org. Magen David Edom is Red Cross in Israel. They need armored ambulances because the Hamas terrorists, Islamic Jihad, all these terrorist groups, they shoot in ambulances because this is what they do. Again, world's most evil people.
World's most evil people. That's right. Because Jews didn't do nothing. And to the point I mentioned earlier, well, why then?
Why is a
Jew always worrying about being kicked out of every place? Because they didn't do nothing, just like Randy Fine explains.
We are a people that has been kicked out of every place we've ever lived for 2,000 years. Every single place.
Jews have been kicked out of every country we've ever lived, and it's never been our own fault.
Every single place.
Never been our own fault. That's right. Can never do anything wrong. Why? Because of their chosenness. It's unable for them. They're unable to see. Okay, last thing I'm going to cover here is about Norman Finkelstein's comments about billionaires. There's apparently no billionaire Jews in America that have any allegiance to Israel. What now?
The times when they ran, they had to make a choice. If they want to support Israel, they have to support Trump.
I don't think so. Well, I don't buy that. I think they are, what they're doing, again, is they're trying to save Israel because they understand that Israel is basically cooked. And the only way to save it is for Netanyahu to lose.
Actually, I don't even see that as a consideration by these folks. Mm-hmm. Their consideration is we got to get rid of Trump. We got to get rid of Trump. And if the price is Israel losing, we will accept that price. That's how I read the situation. And that, of course, flies in the face of the claim that all these American Jews are looking out only for Israel. It's not true. These are Jewish elites entrenched in the United States.
Yeah.
They are not Zionists because they believe there is a future for Jews here. In fact, it's been wonderful for Jews here in the United States. And they think Trump is a menace.
They're not anti-Zionists.
No, they're not anti-Zionists. They're not anti-Zionists. Because they're all Jewish supremacists. They are, unfortunately.
Well, that's exactly.
I grew up exactly. with them. I yeah, know yeah. them. You see, you have to, as George Lukacs famously said, you have to see the present as history. Back then, there was no interest in Israel. Israel, when we were going to school, was a backwater. It was very poor. I mean, it's hard to believe now. It was very, very poor. Very simple, egalitarian. It was, you call it primitive communism. That was, that's a term from Marx, primitive communism. It was a kind of primitive communism in Israel. American Jews, when we were growing up, they were ready to conquer the world. They knew or believed that they were going to be at the commanding heights of American society. And you know what? They were right.
They were.
They achieved what They didn't think about Israel. So I would not. In that era, they thought Jews were smarter. That's for sure. But there was no loyalty to Israel.
They were concerned with America because it's in America that you can gain your wealth and gain your influence and gain your power and gain all these things that you need to do in order to secure Israel. This is, the other guy he's talking to that makes a valid point about they are trying to save Israel. There's all these, they just see Netanyahu as a big optics problem and just get rid of him, but the main project will continue after him. Norman Finkelstein is a liar. There's no such thing as a Jewish anti-Zionist. It's impossible. He's there to cover for the Zionist. What are you talking about? There's no billionaire Jews in America that supports Israel? What are you talking about? Miriam Adelson, and of course Sheldon before that. John Combe, Michael Bloomberg, Larry Ellison, Bernie Marcus, Bill Ackman, Mark Benioff, Yuri Milner, Paul Singer, Chaim Sabin, Jay Schottenstein. Sumner Redstone wasn't that super openly pro-Israel, but all his family and those who got all his money, they are. Man, Miriam and Adel Sheldon alone have been among the largest Republican donors, contributing over $600 million total of U.S. Federal Reserve notes to Donald Trump's campaign and related GOP causes, right? Why? Why? Because she wants the West Bank for it. She wants to have expansion in Israel. They call Trump to get him to move the embassy, whatever. And then later on, they schmooze him and say, oh, you will. They give him prices they know that you just need to butter him up, and then you can get what you want with Trump. They understand that. It's very easy, right? Just shower him with praise and tell him how great he is. Give him awards, and he'll bow down and do what you want. They probably do have blackmail on the guy anyway. But, I mean, remember when Donald Trump was crowned the King of Jerusalem?
Okay. Give thanks to Hashem, for his work is good, his kindness endures forever. Presented to President Donald J. Trump for his extraordinary and heroic efforts. I like that. To help the state of Israel and the Jewish people. He and his family should be blessed eternally. For the Israel Heritage Foundation, July 10th, 2023. I want to thank you. Let me put it this way. If we don't win, Israel's in big trouble. I really mean it. I mean it. Israel's in big trouble.
100 more years. 100 more years.
What is this, a test? The rabbis give me a test. And no men in women's sports.
It's like you're giving away the country. It's like, no. Well, at least we didn't have any men in women's sports. And it was like, well, you still do, actually, but okay. Great win. All right. So obviously this is just, oh my gosh, what even begin at this, right? This is them controlling him ceremonially, right? How many clips is there of them talking about how they control and are asserting influence over American politics? Let's check in on a couple, shall we?
Miri, you and Sheldon created a lot of relationship over the years with politicians at the state level, especially at the federal level. I want you to share with everyone why is it so important and how do you do it? Again, writing checks is part of it, but there is more than writing just checks. So how do you do it?
Can you allow me not to answer?
You choose.
I want to be truthful, and there are so many things that I don't want to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, we don't want specific, but that's okay. But everyone should know here how important it is to get involved, because the reason that both of you were able to make huge differences is because you got involved. and you spent a lot of time and, yes, money, a lot of money on it, but you got involved and you cared. And that's what everyone here need to know.
Even if he were to retire right now, Donald Trump will have done enough for the Jewish people and for the Jewish state to earn his eternal place. To earn his eternal place in the Jewish history.
Just as I promised, I recognize Israel's eternal capital and opened the American embassy in Jerusalem. Jerusalem became the capital. I also recognized Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights. You know, Miriam and Sheldon would come into the White House probably almost more than anybody outside of people that worked there. And they were always after. And as soon as I'd give them something, always for Israel. As soon as I'd give them something, they'd want something else. I'd say, give me a couple of weeks, will you please? But I gave them the Golan Heights and they never even asked for it. Isn't that right, Miriam? Look at Miriam. She's back there. Stand up, Miriam. Stand up. Miriam and Sheldon would come into the office. They'd call me. He'd call me. I think they had more trips to the White House than anybody else I could think of. Look at her sitting there so innocently. She's got $60 billion in the bank. $60 billion. I think she's saying no more. And she loves Israel, but she loves it. And they would come in, and her husband was a very aggressive man, but I loved him. He was a very aggressive, very supportive of me. And he'd call up, can I come over and see you? I say, Sheldon, I'm the president of the United States. It doesn't work that way. He'd come in. But I actually asked her, I'm going to get her in trouble with this, but I actually asked her once. I said, so Miriam, I know you love Israel. What do you love more? The United States or Israel? She refused to answer. That might mean Israel, I must say.
Absolutely amazing. That's the point. There's nothing to this. It's not religious. It has nothing to do with anything. What's the drive of these people then? You have more money you can dream of. It's all these, and you continue to invest and do things on behalf of Israel and Israeli interest. Let's end the segment here with a clip from Pascal Lottas. He's running this Neutrality Studies YouTube channel, and it's the biggest load of bunk that I've seen in a long time. They have serious in-depth discussions about Israel and about, you know, Zionism and things like this. That's the one who had Norman Finkelstein on there. But here he is with Yaakov Rabkin, who's a professor at Quebec, at Montreal University, trying to convince you that, in fact, everything you see, if Israel is unpopular, if Zionism is not going down that well, let's just blame Europeans for it.
It's important to remember that Zionism is a European movement. It's European ethnic nationalism of Poland, Lithuania, that is transferred to Palestine. Very often it's exclusionary nationalism, because you can have inclusive nationalism, like in France, you know, you become citoyen, and that's enough. But there is also the ethnic nationalism, which today is very much in evidence in many countries, in Poland, in Ukraine, in Latvia, Estonia, and so on. So this was transferred into Palestine, and that became the ideological basis of Zionism.
Absolute ridiculous. The type of academic poop that you can find on YouTube now is just unbelievable. Goes largely unchallenged. They could just spew it out. No, none of these people can ever censor or ban for any of their lies and their garbage, right? Yeah, I was reading his Wikipedia page. He wrote a book called What is Modern Israel? And it examines what he calls Protestant origins of Zionism. That's right. There's nothing to do with Jews whatsoever, because of a couple of dumb Protestants that were convinced by their fascination with the Hebrews and Jews, because of course their Bible and their Christianity, right? So therefore, they're the ones to blame for it. It's unbelievable. You can never, as soon as they get in to explain to you what their project is all about, you'll hear nothing but lies. And Norman Finkelstein really is the epitome of that. Throw him in the trash heap. Hey, thank you guys for joining us. We'll be back with more here soon. Thank you for joining us in the member section. We appreciate you guys. Much love to all of you. Much love to all our executive producers and producers. We can't do this without you guys. Thank you so much. We'll be back soon. Hope you enjoy. Now, do make sure that you follow us on our Rumble channel for more Red Ice TV on rumble.com or on X at Red Ice TV. You can, of course, go to redice.tv as well. Tune in to our live streams and shows, Flashback Friday, live on Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern, No Go Zone Wednesdays at 5 p.m. Eastern. We also do interviews, videos, clips, and Western Warrior is available Tuesdays, exclusive for our supporters and subscribers at redicemembers.com or on our locals, redicetv.locals.com or subscribestar.com/redice. Get a membership, check out everything that we do, and support the show.